My name is Jeff Cronenweth. I am the cinematographer on A Million Little Pieces, and you're listening to The Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I'm a director and owner of BC Media Productions. This is The Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals and filmmakers. Today, we talk with legendary director of photography, Jeff Cronenweth, about his career, cinematography tips, and his latest film, A Million Little Pieces. The Go Creative Show is supported by Hedge, Shutterstock, Rule Boston Camera, and Premium Beat. Well, we've got a massive show for you guys today. Jeff Cronenweth is back on The Go Creative Show talking about his new film, A Million Little Pieces. Now, if you don't know, Jeff Cronenweth is the cinematographer for a whole bunch of gigantic movies that you know and love. Fight Club, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Social Network, Gone Girl. In fact, he was on Go Creative Show talking about Gone Girl a couple of years ago. And if you haven't heard that one, I suggest you do. So you can imagine, with a portfolio like that, what this guy has to teach us all. And it's all coming up in just a few minutes. A great discussion with Jeff Cronenweth. But before we get there, a couple of things. One, follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, because you'll be the first to know who is upcoming on Go Creative Show. You'll be the first to know when a new episode drops. And also, you get an opportunity to ask questions to our guests. We always put upcoming guests in our social media, and then you guys have a chance to have your question heard on the show. In fact, we ask a couple of your questions on this episode with Jeff, and that's coming up in just a couple of minutes. So it's a great way to know what's going on with the show and then also have your voice heard. Now, our interview is just a moment away, but before we get there, I want to quickly talk about our sponsor, Shutterstock. Shutterstock, of course, is where you go for the world's leading royalty-free videos and photos. They've got music now, an incredible blog, and so much more. But I want to bring your attention to Shutterstock Select, which is the best of the best that Shutterstock has to offer. We're talking about thousands of blockbuster-quality, budget-friendly clips. Okay? This is the best of the best. You get exceptional quality, premium, high-curated footage captured in up to 8K, created by leading filmmakers, using equipment like RED cameras, Zeiss Master Prime lenses, and all the great equipment that we love. So excellent quality, really good gear, professional filmmakers, and the best part is that the pricing is so simple because all Shutterstock Select clips are $3.99, and that includes unlimited worldwide use. So it's a no-brainer that this is where you go when you want the best, royalty-free footage that you can possibly get. It's right there at Shutterstock.com. So go to Shutterstock.com, hover over footage, scroll down to Shutterstock Select, and enjoy. You guys will be blown away by what the Shutterstock Select library has to offer for you. Okay, we've got so much to talk about, and I don't want to waste another minute. So let's get right to it with director of photography, Jeff Cronenweth. So I'm here with Jeff Cronenweth, the return of Jeff Cronenweth here on Go Creative Show. We have you here talking about A Million Little Pieces, but you've also been on for, what was the last time you were here? I'm trying to remember. I think it was Gone Girl, I believe.
Could have been.
I think it was Gone Girl. Yeah. But so happy to have you back. So thanks for your return visit here at Go Creative Show.
Happy to be here.
So you were just telling me before we started recording that you're in Las Vegas. Are you able? Can you talk about the shoot that you're on right now or no?
I can talk about it for sure. I just can't say the specific acts that we're doing or that. But it's a commercial directed by Sasha Levinson, who did last year's campaign, which apparently was the most viewed Las Vegas kind of tourism campaign ever. So she's back, and she invited me to join, and they're going to try to elevate that success to even a more compelling, immersive campaign.
So you're doing a campaign for Las Vegas tourism?
Correct. So we get access to everywhere, all the acts, all the artists, and all the special places that, and we're attempting to make it more about why you'd want to come here, because it gets you closer to what their experiences are, such as, you know, different performers or the things that happen here, because this is the only place these events actually occur, you know, and the surprises that can happen. For example, there is a lounge bar, and I shoot here fairly often, but it's not a destination that I get to a lot. And it seems to me that the casinos have all kind of are maturing, and the bars are becoming less plastic flash and more kind of grounded, sophisticated. And I think that's just kind of like currently what society is kind of going towards. And so they'll have a performer there, and then anybody that, you know, any rock star or musician or actor could show up and play five sets in that room. And apparently it happens quite a bit all over the strip. And so that's kind of the intimate settings that they're starting to go for, where you can see something that you would never get that opportunity in another city in the world. So it's kind of cool, actually.
So Las Vegas, I mean, is already kind of like a big movie set. I mean, I can only imagine that it's, I mean, there can't be any lack of great shots there. I mean, every time you turn around, there's some interesting vignette or something going on. How does it compare? Yeah, how does shooting in Las Vegas compare to shooting, you know, in the quote real world outside of the Vegas Strip?
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of the task at hand for us, is to not get so glossy with it that you disconnect to it, and actually make it about the humanity of enjoying these places and the experiences that you'll have. So yeah, you kind of do that, but you add a little bit of humanity to it, and then make it so that we're all connect to it. Otherwise, it's just images with no contextual structure that don't relate to anybody. And so that's our assignment.
Huh? When is that supposed to be released?
You know, I believe it's all stuff like at the end of this year or beginning of next year.
Oh, so a quick turnaround. It's fairly quick.
Fairly quick, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I'm excited to see that, because the way you're kind of describing how your approach to Las Vegas sounds interesting, and the concept of it maturing is interesting as well. I'm only there normally for like conferences and things like that. You know, I go to NAB, not every year, but every once in a while. And like it's always been kind of like work. It's never been for play, but it's such a unique place.
It is. And you know, a lot of people find it to be too unreal, too plastic, too make-believe. But I find it myself, my personal experience, that if you come here for food, every chef has a restaurant. They have the biggest wine buying capacity of anywhere in the world. So they beat everybody, and they have all the great collections. And you go to pick up a show now and then, and it's pretty fantastic. That's what I use it for.
Last time I was there, I spent a lot more time on, I think, is it Lombard Street, like the original Las Vegas? I can't remember the name of the street, but there's like the old Vegas Street. And yeah, then, you know, the street we all know now. In the old Vegas, and I can't remember the name of it, but someone listening is screaming at their radio right now, but it like had a lot more going on there. Like there were more restaurants, there was more culture there. It felt more real than the main strip. I don't know if you went down there at all, or if that's even part of the tourism campaign.
Yeah, no, we're going to be down there. We haven't been yet. I mean, we scouted it, and it's Frontier Street is where they have a Frontier Experience, where they've closed it off. It's all pedestrian traffic, and it's amazing, because it's old Vegas with a lot of character. It's just a completely different kind of experience. You know, it's not overwhelming like some of these casinos that have 4,000 rooms.
Yes. Okay. So that's the street with like the covered roof or whatever. That's a big screen.
Yeah, it's called the Frontier Experience.
All right, so Lombard Street, that's San Francisco. What am I talking about? That's the curvy, windy road,
correct,
in San Francisco. I'm losing my
that's
mind.
Right.
Well, to me, I mean, I'm in Boston, so it's like either East Coast or West Coast. Every West Coast icon is just somewhere over there. I can't distinguish
it. That's funny. Yeah, that's great.
I saw A Million Little Pieces this morning. I thought it was fantastic. I loved it. I really, really liked it. Really good performances. Cinematography, of course, was fantastic. I expect nothing less from you. And
oh boy.
I'd love to dig into it. I mean, how did you first get involved in this project? Because this is, I mean, this is one of those, you know, huge pop culture, you know, iconic, influential books, but from a while ago. And for the movie to just kind of happen now is almost, it's almost kind of shocking to me. It seems like it's so far removed from when the book had its big pop.
Well, it's two stories, and don't hold me to exact dates, but if I'm correct, I believe the book came out around 2003 or 2004,
somewhere around there.
And as we all know, there's a little backstory to it. It came out. He went on the show with Oprah. She fell in love with the book, and
the author did. Yeah,
and, James Frey, and he was a Cinderella story and an instant success and quite a dramatic journey because it was an autobiography, but. Later on, she found out that not everything was, he embraced a few things that didn't happen. And so, she took that personally and it was quite the, you know, beat down and the energy of the book got swallowed up. It's ironic because I had, Mark Romanek had reached out to me and, we had discussed that he had the opportunity to direct it and asked if I would shoot it. So I knew the material quite well. And then once this controversy occurred, that opportunity went away and the book got shelved. And so the movie was gone. A little quick going backwards, you know, I'm not going to defend anybody because I don't know what everyone was thinking at the time when it happened, but
sure.
You know, I think when you do an autobiography, I think it's common knowledge in the industry to allow your. I mean, this is what I was told that like as long as 85% of it is true, you're allowed a little bit of room to embellish to actually make a reader enjoy your story more. And I think that's what he did. And because it was such a visual book. Experience that he went through in the book, you know, it's a rehab story and he went through it that, and I think because it had affected so many people, the fact that there are parts that weren't exactly, I don't know how to say it, things that were elaborated on.
Well, I remember at the time there was a big, you know, like you said, he went on Oprah, the book got picked up. Everybody, of course, loved it. I mean, it's a fantastic book and a great story. But then when it was revealed that not every single moment, not every single story was factual, Oprah kind of felt that was, you know, she was supporting the book. And for this to not be 100% true, it looked bad on her. It blew up to this big controversy. And I remember discussions at the time were like, well, you know, what is a book anyway? Yes, it's autobiographical, but where is the line between, you know, creative license and, you know, cold hard facts? And it was an interesting discussion that was going on at that time. You kind of saw that across everything. I mean, this was for people that, you know, are younger or just didn't care or wasn't paying attention to it. This was a huge deal at the time. It really shook the entertainment industry, not even just for literature, but for everything.
Absolutely. 100%. And the thing that walk away that are the takeaway that I had, you know, after that went away was this profound disappointment from the standpoint that it was such a great message and it had potential to help so many people. And it was such an interesting story that I would have bought it if it was a fictional story, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's to me why it was so interesting, some 15 years later when, Sam Taylor Johnson called me, who directed the film, and asked if I had, you know, if I was interested in doing a picture and would I consider doing this, and told me the parameters of it which were rather restraining. We can get into that in a minute. But she asked me, do you know the material? And I'm like, yeah, quite well, actually, because I never quite let go because I could see that picture then. So I was already prepped for it in my mind, at least. To go at it again. So that was rather fun, a circle of life that it came back.
Oh, the director didn't know that you were slated to shoot it the first time?
No, not at all.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. So they just came back to you naturally. That's so wild.
Crazy, right?
Well, I'd love to hear the constraints that you were just talking about. Like, what were the parameters that were, sounds like they were challenging, whatever they were.
As you know, anytime you take a book, and this was quite an elaborate book, a long book, you have to then tackle that into a screenplay. And so that in itself usually pares down the book, condenses the most memorable moments, and tries to compact it all into something that's presentable in a theatrical timeline. And so yeah, you always have to pick your moments and create. And but then along with that, there was boundaries to recreating this opportunity. And one of them was a financial restraint that was put on to the project. And so we were limited budgetly what we could do, which it's funny because once the project started to come together and Sam was able to pull in the cast that she did and the crew that she did, it would have been easy to probably raise, you know, twice or three times the budget that we ended up shooting under. But there was boundaries that were put into place. So those in and of itself, and I would let audiences decide after they get an opportunity to see it, is what kind of drove us to a lot of the choices that we had to make. And so it was a 21-day shoot, and it was a $4 million budget.
Mm. Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, I've 21-day shoot. I mean, the girl with the dragon tattoo was 156 shoot days, to put things in perspective.
Wow.
And you know, you add that shoot days. So you add weekends and travel to Europe. I think we went four times. That was 11 months of my life. So this was rather, I mean, I loved the idea of that challenge. You know, can I, you know, having shot predominantly big movies, can I then bring the sensibilities of this project to the screen and still craft it in a way that has been kind of my style and signature and what the weight of this material deserves? And so that was one of the exciting parts. That, along with I love Sam Taylor Johnson and her husband Aaron Taylor Johnson, and since they were both co-screenplay adapters or writers from the book, he was the lead actor and she directed the movie. Their collaboration together is like this contagious kind of energy that when you meet them, you want to be part of it. And so those things kind of all made it a very, very appealing challenge for me.
Do you feel like you were able to achieve what you wanted to under those, you know, under that budget constraint?
I do. I mean, the book is huge. And when you take away, when you have to do something and you have to be creative about how to present the things, oftentimes that's when you make your best filmmaking choices or apply your experience in the best way. There are things that would have been better to kind of give an audience more of that journey and to immerse them in what it was like. But I don't think that the walk away after seeing it is any less emotional or effective. And I think the message is clear. And so I think we did a good job with what we had. I think we did a good job, period. It doesn't matter what we had. I think it's a good, great little movie that I'm very proud of. I think it looks great. And I think the performances are wonderful. And the one of the things that was on my list of do not do's, or that I was overly aware of throughout the whole project, is it can't come off looking like a small movie or a baby movie. There's nothing that gives it away. At least that was my, you know, you get to be the one to decide if I accomplished that, but that's what my goal was.
It definitely doesn't look like a small movie at all. I think the only area where I can see it being budget conscious is how restrained your set is. Like you're really only, there's not a lot of locations. And
no,
it doesn't appear to have a lot of visual effects. So, you know, the big ticket items you don't seem to have. So it just, but it doesn't look like there were accommodations made for the budget. It just seems like that's what the story was. I mean, you have huge actors in it. I mean, this thing, I'm surprised to hear that budget just knowing the cast that's in there. You know, that's remarkable.
Yeah, let alone any of those guys that are in it. You know, that would have been a small percentage of their normal fees. You know, so
yeah.
It was it really had a beautiful cast, and each of their performances are rather unique and interesting. And I'm chuckling because you can't not think of Billy Bob Thornton.
I know.
I mean, both as an amazing human being and as such a great character that he created in this picture. So,
is it difficult when you're working with, you know, big name actors? You got Billy Bob Thornton there, Giovanni Ribisi, Juliette Lewis. You have people that, you know, they've been doing this for a while. They're professionals. They're clearly working at a discount. Is there anything that becomes challenging from your perspective where maybe these actors become a little bit more demanding, or they become harder to work with because they're already going into a project at far less than what they're normally working for? I mean, did you feel that? Does that happen?
I've heard that it happens, and I'm sure it does. But for us, everybody, you know, the way that Sam and Aaron invited everybody to participate in this and knowing ahead of time what our challenges were, everybody was on board. You know, that was the terrifying part for me, is as we got closer and closer to shooting, I started thinking, like, our days are so tight and there's no margin of error if one department drops the ball. In other words, if an outfit doesn't match, or there's a continuity gap, or any kind of a makeup where, he had prosthetics and his teeth were one of the, and some of his nose scar from the initial, from the opening of the movie,
yeah,
were things that take, they always take time, you know. Or for me, if a camera went down or a generator failed or something, we wouldn't make it. That would be it, because we had no like padding to do it. And more or less, we went right through it, and everybody was there on time, and everybody had, you know, happily participated. And that's, you need that. And I keep referring back to kind of Aaron and Sam, because it was their kind of way that they orchestrated and their leadership that made everybody so comfortable and want to participate. No, we didn't have any of those things. You know, you're constantly reminded about what you don't have or how fast you have to go. But other than that, I think it was fun for all of us to find our creative space within those parameters.
How does a tight budget affect your pre-production?
It does, you know, everything's smaller. It was less time, but it was enough time. We were able to, we were prepared, and my guys have done all the big movies with me. So when we went into this one, they knew what it was about and what we had to do. And when we were leapfrogging or when we were planning out, and I give credit, at least for my side of it, from all the productions I've worked with David Fincher, and he comes from that school of Hitchcock, in that you make a majority of that movie before you ever start your first day of shooting. And that gives you the most opportunity to succeed, because you've eliminated most of the problems if you properly prep the project. Now, obviously you can't find everything, because every day there's fantastic surprises that give you creative opportunities to salvage yourself.
That's a great way to look at it. Fantastic surprises that give you an opportunity. I mean, that sounds like a man who's done this before.
Well, you can let it beat you down, or you can go, okay, you know, I mean, for example, we had a scene yesterday in this beautiful room, and the references and the things that we talked about were reminiscent of, say, Cotton Club. And they told us all about how the vents in the ceiling are electronic and they close so that you can keep atmosphere in, so you can have texture in the air when you turn on the lights, and it's a jazz club feel. And get everything going in the morning, and they're like, oh yeah, the fire department won't let us put smoke in here. You need 72 hours ahead of time. I'm like, that's fantastic. Why didn't you tell us that 2 days ago? You know, we would have probably tried to work something else out. And so rather than just go, that's it, that scene will have no heart now because it won't have the texture that I imagine in my head, I went about it in a different way, and we solved it. And so, in hindsight, I think that it's just as good, if not better, because we had to come up with some other ideas to make it, to keep it in the style that we're going for. So that happens to everybody every single day. Whoever at the end of the day makes the most educated choices is the one that wins. And that's, you know, it doesn't matter if it's David Fincher or Steven Spielberg, you know, on the beaches of Normandy, those clouds change every day. Things, the equipment doesn't get there. This doesn't work. It takes longer to get the shot there. And however you resolve that in the end, because there are no disclaimers when you watch these movies, mm-hmm. Those are the people that win.
Let's take a quick moment and talk about Hedge. Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers. It's super fast, super easy, because you can import multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations all at the same time. So I was just using it yesterday, as I do on every shoot, and I'm thinking to myself, like, it was so crazy that before Hedge, I was dragging files all over the Finder. Like, it's insane, because your media is the most important thing. At the end of your shoot, your media is it. You know, that's what everybody's paid for. That's what everyone has put their time and attention into doing and making, is the media, right? So you want to treat it the right way. You don't want to just drag it all over the Finder. That's insanity. So I'm using Hedge now, and I import all of my sources, which is, you know, all the camera cards, audio cards, behind the scenes photographers, all that stuff. It all goes into Hedge. It's right there on the left-hand column. And then the right-hand column is where I have my destinations. And of course, I always have two backups. So I've always got two drives there. I press transfer and I just let it go. In fact, I pressed the transfer and we went to go have lunch. And then immediately I got a notification on my phone because I have the Hedge Connect app. So I was notified when the transfer was done. And it's like, I give the hard drive to the client and I'm good. You know, like I don't have to worry about it. Everything was done fast. It was done accurately. It was done right. And I suggest you do the same thing. Go to hedge.video/go-creative-show. That'll get you 20% off the full license. Use the coupon code go-creative-show at checkout to take advantage of that. And check out their other licenses too. They got a whole bunch of different options that you can enjoy. And the app is always being updated, always. So when you download Hedge and you buy Hedge, you are investing in a company that is constantly going to be investing back into the app. So you're going to get the latest and greatest at all times with Hedge. So check it out for yourself, hedge.video/go-creative-show. When you're creating the look for a million little pieces, what was your inspiration?
Listening to a lot of people that have been through the experience themselves and deciding that I needed to have the visuals from my effort have to have the weight of what's happening. And I need to push it so that you really get a sense of what an addict goes through both during and after addiction, and not lose the humanity of it and the relationships that come in this story, and at the same time stay out of the way of the story. Don't make it so heavy-handed, or don't let your ego get involved, which I say because it's so easy to put lights in places and be heroic when it's not serving the story. And, you know, I came from, my father was a cinematographer and his father was a portrait photographer. And my grandmother was a Busby Berkeley dance girl. And so we have a entertainment lineage. And the one thing that everybody was always, made first in regardless of what your contribution was the story. The story's always first. Make the story right and everything falls into place. And so that was kind of my motto, mantra to myself going into this, is bring as much to you as you can. And in some cases, we did a little hyper real stuff in order to embellish the moment and cover for what we couldn't do with visual effects by in-camera effects. And then let the performances have a great stage to reveal themselves. And that was my That was my goal.
The film has a lot of realism in it. I mean, every light is motivated. You use a lot of practicals inside of the bedrooms and certainly any night scenes. There is one particular, I guess I would call it a prop piece in a way, but it does affect your lighting, is the exterior of this facility has like a mosaic-y patterned red decorative wall that sort of is all over the place on the set. And it creates an opportunity for you to, what it creates an opportunity, first of all, to have, you know, visual representation that sort of grounds you. So you know where you are because it's very visible in a lot of the exterior shots. But then when you're inside, you use it as a pattern that you use it as a pattern that ends up on the wall when sunlight comes through it. And you're always exactly. being reminded of this exterior mosaic wall. And I thought that was a really interesting choice, particularly because it ties into the idea of a million little pieces and breaking apart and, you know, coming back together and all of that. Am I looking too deeply into it, or was this something that was planned?
You're not looking too deeply into it. I'll be honest with you that the million little pieces part wouldn't have been come from me, but we had a wonderful production designer named David Bomba, and his thought process and his own personal experiences that he brought to this were amazing, and that was one of them. And I embellished that, and we worked very closely together, as you always should anyways, but even more so in this because, you know, we had to cannibalize certain sets. We drug some of those walls around from room to room to bring them back. And we you know, made that extra step to keep tying things together because we were limited to the spaces that we could shoot in and our locations and limited, you know, company moves, which usually kill a production, were something that we couldn't really do. So we had to utilize everything we could and repurpose things. And in that, that was like a theme that we wanted to do. And we did want you always to be reminded that we're in the same place regardless of where we find ourselves on this campus. We were quite lucky, if we want to segue into a quick little stories about the location.
They found
a facility, and it was David's urging. You know, all of us were resisting it because it was it's hour and a half to a little less to 2 hours, depending on traffic, from Los Angeles. And so that was like, you're going to be doing long hours and you're going to be grinding all day long, you know, because our schedule is so tight. Do we really want to spend, you know, 3 hours, 4 hours a day driving to this place? But in the end, it was a fantastic find. It was a closed down mental hospital facility that now, as the state has donated to the Cal State College system, but it was in Pomona. And I think there was something like 700 acres. And they had all these wow. old facilities, and we just cannibalized. You know, we made the bus station what used to be an old gymnasium, and we used the hospital facilities, and we used housings, and we used cafeterias and buildings and dorms. And it became like our own back lot, and afforded us the opportunity to limit the amount of moves and get as many of those scenes on camera as we can and not just lose time by transportation or driving or any of the other things that come up when you have a lot of locations.
Did you create any sets on stages?
Yeah, no, but we created sets within the facilities there. There was two giant auditoriums, and we you know, put the plane fuselage in there, and we shot the first opening scene in the movie where not the opening scene, we shot where he's on the airplane on the way to the facility, and we built other parts and extended things and just, you know, made it work.
What a great find. So all of those places, it was a campus full of, you know, buildings that you could just have access to. That's amazing.
It was fantastic, you know, and as soon as we got there and walked around, you know, all of our heads were hanging low because we knew it was the right place and we knew we were going to be making the drive every day.
Oh my God.
Which is not the hardest thing in life. I don't want to sound like a crybaby, but you know, it's just like we all thought like, well, somewhere downtown or somewhere in the vicinity of it. But in the end, this really proved to be a genius find and a great idea, and we all did it.
That's what I meant even earlier when I was talking about the actors. because it's like you're doing something for less money than you normally would. And any sort of inconvenience is just always going to be coupled with, well, Jesus, I mean, I'm not even getting full rates for this. You know what I mean? It's like, like to have all these extra things, I can see becoming frustrating. And, but that said, now knowing what you had, you know, afforded to you, that, I mean, that's, you can't say no to that. I mean, the drive sucks, but that's just, it's too perfect.
It was too perfect. And the opportunity was too good. And, you know, just to note on that, I always have this attitude, like, don't take it if it's going to be a problem later. But if you do, then don't bring that attitude with it, because you already made that choice. You didn't have to make that choice. And, you know, all my guys were on board and everybody helped. And even, you know, the camera houses gave us bargains. And then I had friends that loaned me their cameras. And, you know, I've been waiting a long time to pull in some of these favors, and this was the right time to do it. And so, so I did. And so, you know, I don't know that a lot of people could have pulled off that for the budget that we did without really reaching in for favors and getting stuff that we had all accumulated over the years. So
what did you shoot on?
I used a red, it's the new, they have a camera that has the full wide chip on it called the Monstro. And so I have one of my own, and then I had friends that loaned us things, and we ended up having three cameras, which sounds quite excessive for a baby movie, but this is a good chance to talk about the specific camera techniques. I had the notion that most of my Fincher movies, actually every movie I've photographed, we've always had two cameras, and I had learned through Fincher and then on my other projects, really to utilize them in coverage and cut down a lot of shots. And if you're very clever about it and clever about eye lines, then it becomes a fantastic tool. And we always thought we'd move from scene to scene and leave behind inserts and pick up little shots that could be done while I'm setting up something next. So we're all fluid and we're always shooting, you know, there's no downtime. But there was many, many situations as I was prepping that I decided, and again, this is like you creatively find a voice that you're gonna present, and then the reality of some of the things come, and then you figure out what is the best way to do it within these restraints. And so the movie's about addiction. The movie's about a guy who's kind of losing his mind and going through the withdrawal process. And it's rather chaotic. So I thought hand in hand with something where I wouldn't have the time and I wouldn't have the pre-lights and I wouldn't have the rigging crews to do what I might normally do on a bigger show, that I would try to embellish three cameras. And the thing about that is, you know, from a cinematographer standpoint and a filmmaker standpoint, you know, you have to be very careful about eye lines, because that will just wreck a scene or cause uncomfort that usually isn't something you're going for. Occasionally, like in The Insider, Michael Mann did it geniusly to have people looking the wrong way, but that was to create tension. And that's not, you know, in most scenes, that's not the tension that you want to draw. So three cameras, what do you do with three cameras? Well, I kind of thought that if I had less control and I let go of things and still keeping my aesthetics to what I'm happy with or comfortable with, but that it would force me to be less precious about things, and that I would create light sources usually generated from one part in the room that would then give me a 180-degree angle on things that were still pretty. In other words, it's always like if you get multiple cameras, you start shooting different angles. Not only are actors looking the wrong way, but multiple light sources now become ugly in one direction and pretty on the other. And so you can't do that if you want to maintain the aesthetics of something. But I staged it away with as many single sources or one broad source, and had this window of half light and backlight, and we were able to utilize three cameras in a lot of setups. And, you know, if you can do a scene in three shots and move on to your next, and you can do eight scenes a day, that's pretty fantastic.
you know, with my production company, we've explored like multi-camera stuff. And what we've found sometimes, we don't do it that much, but sometimes it becomes so challenging with lighting that the time, you're not saving that much time because you're spending more time trying to get every light out of every shot and having everything perfect, that it really just would have been faster in those situations to just shoot one camera and then move a few things. But I mean, my circumstances are certainly different than yours, but did you find challenges with that?
Always, of course. Like, how much do I want to let go of it and how far away from the optimal place to be with the camera do I want to let the other cameras go?
Yeah.
And it just forced me to be more creative about coverage. You know, I would shoot somebody, you know, he's sitting on the floor in the bathroom looking at old photographs of an ex-girlfriend, and I did a wide and a tight of him, and then I actually extended the camera up and over and down onto the insert of the picture that he was looking at, and we shot all three at the same time without seeing each other. And it was motivated by a single window light that he was sitting on the right. And that kind of allowed me to do those kind of things. And so we were able to move fast enough and avoid those complications. You know, sometimes three cameras makes it harder and takes more time. But in this situation, you know, we were very clever about how we did it. And I tend to use guys that are talented, that are on their way to becoming cinematographers anyways. And so everybody contributed. And I love, you know, it's an open room with me. And, you know, if you have a better idea, show it to me. And that's something that, you know, I always loved about Fincher. He's very kind of didactic and dissects every scene and knows ahead of time what it's supposed to be. But he's open-minded and smart enough to know if somebody else standing on the side has a better idea or you miss something, then just show it and make sure it's better. And so that's kind of like what I like my guys to, like, we make it a giant collaboration, which is always the best part for me.
What were the lenses that you used on the film?
I use these, again, because I like this notion of it's a little bit chaotic and you can't make it too precious and you don't want it to be too perfect. So I use Canon K35s, which are these old lenses that have this fantastic coating that allow aberrations to happen. And you don't always know when they're going to happen. But they're kind of like, you can get odd flares, you can get a little depth of field things, you can get textural things. And that was my idea going into it. And they're beautiful. And I've shot them a lot during commercials. But after doing my DI session and after sitting for hours and hours, the problem with the ones that I had and the sets that we had is that you jump from one lens to the next and they don't necessarily have the same resolution or the same qualities. And so it took a lot of effort to make that not apparent on screen.
Yeah.
You know, it was a lot of work to make everything congruent and match together. And since we've done that film, two or three different lens companies have come out with lenses that in theory give you the same things, but have a consistency within the different sizes so that they, you know, a 35 and a 50 don't, you know, take you out of the moment because they so drastically have different properties to them.
So these K35s, they weren't, but even though they're part of the same, I guess, family, they're still just, yeah, because they're old, there's some inconsistencies with them.
Correct.
You know, I heard a lot of cinematographers have been saying recently that they have had like custom modified lens sets direct from the manufacturers. Like, I'm hearing that a lot happen where they'll go and, you know, they'll do camera tests and all that as normally, but then they'll go to the lens manufacturer and have like these small modifications made like just for that project. And that's becoming more and more, I don't know how popular, I'm certainly not doing that at the budgets that I'm working in, but I do hear a lot of directors of photography coming on this show talking about that. Have you experimented with that at all?
Absolutely. And I did a pilot at the beginning of this year, my first venture into television, which was inevitable because it's really, you know, it's really
the new cinema.
No doubt it's some of the most creative and amazing productions being being made now. And so I was just waiting for the right opportunity. And Mark Romanek, ironically, who we started this conversation with, had a pilot, and I went up and we shot that up in Winnipeg at the beginning of this year. And I used Panavision's DXL2, which is the same red 8K monstrous sensor rehoused in a Panavision body that's, you know, more ergonomic to all of us on set. You know, it's really clever what they've done. And then they all had their own color science to it. But the reason I chose that was because the lens choices that we were presented with, you know, and they had, you can shoot those cameras and then shoot wide format glass, like 70 millimeter. And then you get yourself into if you expose properly or don't, like lack of, you know, if you shoot those lenses wide open, then you have this beautiful depth of field control that can get away from you if you're not careful when you're shooting digitally, because the sensors are getting so big now, and the speed of the sensor rather is so fast that you never want to lose one of your great tools, which is depth of field. So you can tell an audience where to look, or you can change backgrounds or textures or the intent of the scene. And Mark and I fell in love with that idea. And then when we went through lenses, Panavision had many sets that we experimented with and found the set that had not even been named yet. And so we might be one of the first productions that got to use it, but you had the ability to kind of tune those lenses to a bouquet that you liked.
Is this Tales from the Loop?
Yeah.
All right. So are you doing the whole series or just the pilot?
Just the pilot. You know, Mark's the EP on the entire run, but he only directed the first episode. And so that's what I signed up for.
Nice. Nice. You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. This one's called The Path to Abundance by Vincent Tone. PremiumBeat.com is where to go for all of your royalty-free music. You can go to PremiumBeat.com and get access to a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. You heard me right, $49. And yes, compare that to other sites. Go ahead. For $49, you don't even get the song. You're going to get stems and cutdowns and loop sets and all sorts of assets so that you can customize the track to fit your project perfectly. So all of this for $49. Plus, their collection of songs is really high quality. I mean, it's just awesome. So you got to check it out for yourself. PremiumBeat.com, and I'll put a link to this song in the show notes. Over at GoCreativeShow.com as well. So check them out for yourself, PremiumBeat.com. And lastly, let's talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. First of all, they've got an incredible inventory. I'm talking cameras, audio, lighting, grip gear, camera dynamics, everything you can imagine. Lenses. So many lenses over there. I mean, they've been around for 35 years plus. They got a gigantic warehouse, and all the Hollywood films that come into Boston are using Rule. So you can imagine what kind of gear they have. But in addition to that, they also have attentive service. They have the best service in the world. Production is mission critical, and Rule has got your back. They're going to give you expert advice and counsel in pre-production. They're going to give you technical guidance when you take the equipment out for your shoot, and they are committed to supporting you while you're on location, the entire time you have their gear. So we're talking about peace of mind. So great quality gear, excellent service, peace of mind. It's everything you want. And we love those guys. They've been a sponsor since day one, and I am constantly going to Rule to either pick up equipment or drop off equipment. I was on the phone with them today, putting in another order. It never ends, people. I love those guys, and they love the Go Creative Show, and you should be supporting them as well. Rule.com, RULE.com. I want to talk about color in our last few minutes here. And then we just have a couple of questions from our audience. You drew some questions out. I put you on Instagram that you were coming on the show, and we got a big response. So we picked our, I think we've got three in here, our three favorites. Okay. So if you have a couple minutes at the end. But I want to talk about your use of color. Now, what I noticed in the film is that the real world, I guess we'll say, the sober world was lit a lot cooler. In the warmer world was where we saw him, you know, tempted. He was either high or in scenes where there was incredible temptations, sex, drugs, alcohol, all of it. It seemed like that's where we had the bokeh in the softness and the warmth and all that. Curious where that decision came from and how color is used to help support the stories.
Okay, that's a fair question. At the beginning, we wanted that to be more something that it causes, it influences his choices and something that he was running away from and his inability to handle situations, which led him to drugs and the addiction and the excessiveness, that the world became closed to him and he was an outsider in it and escaped. And so that made sense to get him there. And then from all the interviews and all the scouts of Hastings and in Minneapolis, where James Frey, the author, actually experienced his rehab, led us all to believe that once you kind of got through the withdrawal process, that it was that nurturing environment that each time you felt like the need to run away or escape, because no one's held there on their own, you can leave whenever you want. That it was that kind of nurturing environment and the reality of it that allowed you to stay grounded and kind of stay in the program as long as, you know, that most of them did. And so in it, we slowly go back to when you finally gets to the scene, the end, conclusion of the movie with his brother, that it's probably one of the warmer and more, at least in shot-wise, softer scenes. And so it was an evolution of it. And we talked a lot about it at the beginning. We even talked about the idea of when he's talking that you don't include, you know, his perspectives on people don't include others. It was always him and a single. And then when we covered him or them, it was over the shoulders. And so we always wanted to make him feel more isolated. And that's
interesting.
It was like something that I had came up with, but then it became kind of like handcuffs us a little bit in different scenes as we kept going through each day's work, going, okay, then we're not going to do this because of this, or we're losing this, the inflection of this moment because we're trying to do this. And I kind of let it go to a certain degree because it wasn't really conducive. It didn't have that much weight to it. And I don't know that anybody would have noticed. And it did stop us from doing things. So I kind of let that go. But there, you explore all those. You have 1,000 ideas of how you're going to do it. And not all of them are going to work out. And not all of them have the weight that you think they're going to until you start doing it. And so that's kind of like, you know, the first few days and then the makeup tests and the scouts and all that stuff kind of formulate that for you. And then you go in and you make it.
Maybe I'm picking up on something that wasn't intended. It did seem like the warmer, like warmer lights, more color, especially like the opening scene, you have almost like Christmas lights up in the room. Every time that he was tempted by Lily, even the bar scene, all of that, that a lot of the temptation seemed to be surrounded by this warmth and comfort almost in a way where, to me at least, it felt like, even though those moments that he's trying to avoid are obviously bad for him, he's comforted by them in a strange way. It felt like that's what you guys were kind of telling from the color palette.
No, I agree with you. That's true. And you know, at the beginning, when he first gets there, he's rebelling against it. So the tonalities, the subtle tones that we could control were all about institution and isolation, and then the temptations and her, which was the you know, that was his relief throughout the whole journey. You know, she was his little angel and spot of color and his nightmare that he was going through. Needed to have those moments so that you could relate more to what they were saying and what the experiences they were presenting to us. And so that was a definitely conscious choices to do.
How are you lighting smoke? You know, we see this a lot. I think since Mad Men, the TV show, more and more characters are smoking on screen. Right. And yeah, it's becoming a pretty big character. Like it's becoming something that helps define who a person is. And, you know, you have to light it. I have a couple of questions. I mean, are these real smoking cigarettes? Are they stage cigarettes? And what are the challenges of lighting smoke?
They're mostly stage cigarettes now, you know. It's funny because yesterday when the smoke, when we were told that we couldn't use smoke in the commercial, I instantly said, well, give everybody cigarettes. And it's a bar and it's Las Vegas and people smoke. And Vegas is also changing. And there's a majority of the casinos that don't allow you to smoke in bar and eating areas. You know, you can smoke on the floor.
Yeah.
And also you have to be self-conscious of actors because you can't force people to breathe secondhand smoke unless it's something that's imperative or they've all agreed to it ahead of time. So, so that idea didn't pan out, but it is a huge part and it does define a character and it does, make another element to someone's personality. And so in an addiction movie, it's a really easy thing to, it's like a pacifier for someone going through anything like that. And it's very, very prevalent in in a recovery center. And so you can take away everything, but that would be the last thing that you want to get rid of down the road. And so it does play a character. It kind of goes hand in hand with my styles anyway. So I'm not always looking to enhance the cigarette smoke in and of itself, but you're always aware that it has to be read and you have to see it. And so it's a combination of, you know, where you put the camera, where the light is. I mean, smoke looks best when it's backlit. So if you do that to some degree, then you're going to be successful. Although backlight in and of itself is not something that is considered modern. And let me explain that for a second.
Like sure, yeah.
Years and years and years ago, you put a backlight up first and that's where everything started. And if you never got any further than that, it's going to look pretty. Well, things have evolved, you know, in style and taste, and that's not always the way. You don't necessarily want something that brings an artificial look or not artificial, but a pushed element to something where glowing hair and all these things may distract from actually the reality of this experience. So then you have to do it through practicals or through window light or something that motivates as opposed to hard light. And that's it. Yeah.
There was a couple of pretty iconic scenes in the film. I think they certainly stand out and I know they're taken from the book. When our main character, James, is walking down the hallway at the very beginning, when he's first entering the rehab facility, I think that's what he was entering, or maybe it was the medical. The brown kind of liquid pouring from the wall and going all over the floor and everything. Talk to us about that scene.
Well, in the book, there's a scene where he has an experience in Europe. He fights with a priest who makes a pass at him. And he then goes out onto the streets and trips into this illusion through his drugs and alcohol that he's in the sewers and he's being overrun by the waste of society or himself, you know, and he's going down the drain and he's going downhill and he's in the sewer. And so obviously we weren't going to be in Europe and we don't have the budget for that kind of visual effect or physical effects. So Sam had this idea of going down this long hallway and allowing the illusion of something happening to him, you know, the side effects or flashbacks of starting the withdrawal process,
yeah,
and allow him to trip out. And so they came up with this very lyrical kind of moment where he gets lost coming down. And that is alluding to raw sewage coming down the walls and his interaction and playing with it. And, you know, it was terrifying at first because it's one of those effects that, on a movie that doesn't have a budget for physical effects, it's one of those effects where, oh, this could go so wrong and be so, it could literally undermine the integrity of the movie if it didn't work out.
Yeah.
And once it started, and Aaron's performance was so magical.
He embraced that moment more than I would have even assumed any actor would. Like he just totally went for it. It was psychotic the way that he dealt with it. And I thought it was a very interesting approach to, you know, kind of almost in a weird way. He was like accepting this delusion and enjoying it in a strange way while fighting it at the same time. It was so bizarre, but really it was a great scene. And so early in the film too, for something like that.
Yeah. And it's kind of like trying to check out to the happy place or be deluded while you're on your way down to, you know, your next reality check. And, yeah. You know, it reminded me a kind of like of Singing in the Rain. And
yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's kind of one of the, like, but he did it in such a poetic way, like the way he moves and the way he danced, the way he was, his excitement about it. I'm lost for the word I'm looking for, but it was a little bit magical, a little bit sparkly, a little bit, I'll let it go at that.
we're all sitting, and now the word's going to come to you. You'll wake up in the middle of the night tonight with the
exactly.
perfect word. And the last thing I wanted to talk about before we get to Instagram questions is just a couple of them. The very last shot of the film is of a whiskey glass, and you see a reflection of James kind of walking away and joining his brother. It's such a cool looking shot. And I have to know, were you actually shooting true, real reflections in the glass, or was that a visual effect?
Nope, that was real.
Wow.
And I'll take credit for that, because I offered that shot up when we were scouting, weeks before we started production. And I was reminded of a shot that David Fincher had done on a music video that my father and I worked on together called Oh Father for Madonna. It's a black and white video. It's a beautiful video. And there was a shot of an empty glass and a guy walking away from her in the morning through the glass. And I thought, wow, that was such a pretty shot. Here's a moment where a guy is coming face to face with his devil. And when he makes that choice, it's such a powerful choice. How do you resolve that? Like, what do you cut to next? Another playing pool or doing this or that. And the idea of like sinking back into the liquid and only seeing them through the reflections, you know, no one quite knew what I was talking about at first. And then we had to play with different densities of the whiskey and mixing it so that there was enough in the right glass to get the reflections and then stage them right. But and there was moments where I was like losing faith that it was going to actually work out.
Really?
Yeah, because it was about distance and spacing him and the walk and where his brother ended up, where Charlie ended up. And then we did the first take after all the, you know, tenseness of solving all the dilemmas, and it was magical. And that was
such a good shot. All right, let's jump into our Instagram questions. There's only a couple. First one, Cinema Freshman on Instagram. I love this question. When you first started out, what area of cinematography did you feel the most insecure in?
When I started out as a cinematographer, probably the scale of the big movies and handling a crew of 30 or 40 people and having the confidence to trust your own instincts and not being shy about what you inherently know in making choices. I think that I learned really early on to embrace fear, because fear is a really good thing. And by that, I mean this, you know, it's easy to do things or to repeat yourself or to get complacent. And I feel like if you're a little bit afraid of that, then you stay fresh. And if it's something that you allow to stop you from progressing, then that's a disability and that's a problem. But if you embrace it and go, yeah, it keeps you on your toes, it keeps you fresh, and you always push the envelope and you keep going to make new things, because you don't want to be lackadaisical. You don't want to shoot what someone else shot. You always want to push the boundaries and try to open up new things and take new risks. And I think I think it's good to be a little bit on edge.
Vinny Bock, V-I-N-I-B-O-C, on Instagram. How are you using LED tech today? You've said in the last time we were on the show and in some articles I've read that you do tend to embrace new technology. And Vinny Bock here is curious how you're using LED now since it's evolved so much.
Well, it's come a long way. It's gotten very pretty and a lot of choices, and it's simplified a lot of tasks that used to be more complicated and time consuming and resource consuming. And on this movie, we didn't have any of those things. And so you can get, you know, much more light, much more quality of light and tonality in single sources. And you can literally plug some of them into wall outlets or use small battery packs that get you out of a lot of situations. And then rather than using gels and stuff, you can change the colors, you know, if you have the correct LED lights or the ones that are that sophisticated. And then the sizes and scales and the patterns that you can create, it's it really opened the door to efficiency and cost, and then it allows you to invent new directions or sources or things where things are motivated from. But that said, a tungsten lamp, a lamp with a filament and a light bulb on a table, a small 1K light, it's nothing gets prettier than that to me.
And lastly, and I think this is a good place to wrap up our talk here, Matt Joe Bryan on Instagram, he says he's a college student and a budding cinematographer and wants to know, what advice do you have for people starting out?
Okay. Do you mean like film school or after film school or film school at all?
Yeah, well, he didn't specify, so I'm just going to say, I think for the person who is trying to get into this industry, trying to become a cinematographer, you know, at the level that you're working at.
Sure.
What advice do you have for them, knowing that they're right now just at the very beginning of their careers?
Right. Be involved. Shoot as much as you can all the time. Wherever an opportunity comes up, volunteer. Go make mistakes, discover, but also watch someone do it that's been doing it, because a lot of answers will be solved for you right away. And you keep that knowledge and it comes back later in the most interesting ways. But honestly, do it. Go do it. Make mistakes. Discover. Find what your talent is, what your talent and isn't. And also be involved and be around it. And then watch a lot of movies.
A Million Little Pieces is released on December 6th. And Jeff, thank you so much for being on, talking about your experiences shooting this film and your others. I mean, wow, it's so nice to have you come back and talk to us. So when you have your next big project, you've got to come by again.
You got it, Ben. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
I want to thank Jeff Cronenwith for coming on the Go Creative Show again to share his experiences in this production industry and talking about his new film, A Million Little Pieces. Thank you, Jeff. I also want to thank Matt Russell for mixing and mastering and making the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com and on Twitter at gainstructure. Of course, our producer, Connor Crosby, you can find him at ignitionvisuals.com and on Twitter, ignitionvisuals. But of course, the show wouldn't exist without our sponsors, so please support all of them. We're talking about Rule Boston Camera, Hedge, Premium Beat, and Shutterstock. Those guys are the reason that this show is in existence. So please support those that support us, and we'll keep pumping out these episodes week after week. Don't forget to follow us on social media so you can have your voice heard on the show. So many great episodes coming up. I want to thank you guys for listening and sharing, and we will see you next week.